2MCE presents In Conversation with Dominic O'Sullivan and Ruben Spargo.
Hello, I'm Ruben Spargo, a journalism student at Charles Sturt University. Today I'll be speaking to Associate Professor Dominic O'Sullivan on the release of his new book, We Are All Here to Stay. But before we meet the author, let me first begin by acknowledging the Ngunnawal and Wiradjuri people, the traditional owners on the land on which we meet today, and let me pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Dominic O'Sullivan is an Associate Professor in Political Science at Charles Sturt University. He is a leading expert in Indigenous rights and has over 50 publications on Indigenous politics and policy. His latest book, We Are All Here to Stay, speaks to citizenship, sovereignty, and the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Dominic joins us now over the phone. Dominic, welcome.
Thank you.
Dominic, I thought I could kick this off by inviting you to briefly set the scene of the book. It draws on the 2007 United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. What is the Declaration, and what is Australia's, among other countries, relationship with the Declaration?
Well, the Declaration was adopted by the United Nations in 2007 by a vote of 144-4. Australia, together with New Zealand, the United States and Canada, were the four countries that voted against it. And it's an instrument that was long in the making. A draft was issued some years before and debated, and there were aspects of it that some states found a little bit controversial, especially suggestion or rights concerning the right to negotiate on questions of resource extraction and mining on Indigenous lands and so on. The Declaration maintains that Indigenous peoples should be allowed to give their free, prior and informed consent before a mining project goes ahead, for example. And that particularly concerned Australia and those other three countries. But there are other aspects of the Declaration that were not so controversial. And really what it does is affirm that the right to self-determination is a right that belongs to all peoples and therefore to Indigenous peoples as much as to anybody else. And, of course, that challenges the colonial presumption that there's a hierarchy of human worth that allows some people to go into other territories and establish government and exert authority and control over the local inhabitants, as happened in Australia. The Declaration's point was really to try to mitigate some of the effects of colonialism.
Let's introduce the liberal approaches of sovereignty, citizenship and democracy now, the principal theoretical concept you use to inform your book's analysis. I'm interested in how you arrived at these concepts and what are their meanings for political relationships in societies?
Yeah, well, they're all big theoretical concepts. And sovereignty is a term that I think is often misused and misunderstood in ways that actually don't get us very far in terms of solutions to pressing moral and political problems. So there's an idea that sovereignty is an absolute, incontestable body of authority, and you either have it or you don't. So it's the idea that Indigenous peoples once had this absolute authority, and the colonial state came and took it away, and now the state uses that sovereign authority over and above Indigenous peoples. And to some extent that's true, and that's why we see claims to Indigenous sovereignty, arguments that sovereignty was never ceded and so on. But if we think of it in those really absolute, rigid terms as an all-encompassing authority, as though political authority can only ever be located in one place, and if you have it, that's great, and if you don't, you're completely powerless. That's all too simple, I think. And I use the Declaration and some of the rights that it affirms relating to education and health and culture and language and economic development, all those things, to show why. And to suggest that if governments or parliaments, for example, in a country like Australia, exercise sovereignty. They don't do it in their own right. They do it by the people's consent. So whatever authority Parliament exercises, or whatever authority Parliament delegates, say to local government or something like that, it only does because it has the people's consent. So that's really important, and that's what I try to look at in the book. And that leads to the question of what does it mean to be a citizen? And in particular, what does it mean to be an Indigenous citizen? In New Zealand, for example, being an Indigenous citizen means the right to speak one's language in Parliament, the right to speak one's language in court proceedings, or the right to go to school and learn in one's language, the right to go to university and study and write one's PhD thesis in one's language, and those sorts of things. Those are very radical ideas in Australia.
Something that seems so harmless, like letting Indigenous kids learn in their own native language, you know, it seems so harmless, but it can have such a great impact.
Yeah, it can have an enormous impact on how kids learn, how kids think about school. The first thing learning in one's own language does is say to kids that school is for me. It's not a foreign or alien institution that's trying to turn me into a white fella, trying to turn me into something that I'm not. Learning in my own language affirms who I am, and it's about a bigger system saying that it's okay to be who I am, and school's going to help me to live in a way that makes sense. Now, that doesn't mean that people can't have access to learning in English, because there are all sorts of practical and political advantages in that, and that's important as well. But there's an awful lot of educational theory and linguistic theory that shows the idea that you've got to make a choice between learning in the English language and learning in one's own language is utterly fanciful. One can do one or both as one pleases, and there are significant educational advantages, cognitive advantages in bilingualism, as well as it being simply and most importantly an expression of that foundational right to culture. As part of the right to self-determination, we all have a right to culture, and it's not a right that belongs to non-Indigenous people in a greater way or a more significant way than it belongs to Indigenous peoples.
I want to turn to the lived experiences of Indigenous peoples. I think it's important for a diverse audience to briefly but clearly understand, you know, where we are now, to understand the transformative potential. You say the liberal concepts of citizenship, democracy, self-determination and sovereignty are not routinely available to Indigenous peoples. What does this space look like?
Well, in New Zealand, for example, one of the distinguishing features of democracy is that there are guaranteed Māori seats in Parliament, and there have been since 1867. And while some people argue that this is only one part of a much bigger expression of a Māori share in sovereignty, and that not all of those parts are fairly in place as many Māori would like, we can still say that no Parliament in New Zealand can consider anything without there being the possibility of Māori participation in those debates and in those deliberations. In the last 10 or 15 years or so, there's always been a proportionate number of Māori in the cabinet. So nothing at all can be considered by a New Zealand cabinet without there being significant and diverse Māori voices participating in those deliberations. When the government puts legislation to Parliament, there's Māori membership of all political parties and Māori people from across the philosophical breadth of the Parliament can question that legislation, question ministers, and ultimately provide some kind of democratic accountability to the Maori population. In all sorts of ways, that's not a perfect system. Maori still suffer much greater rates of ill health, for example. A recent public inquiry found that there's widespread systemic racism in the health system, for example. So it doesn't cure those sorts of problems that arise from colonisation, but what it does ensure is that Maori are always in a position to raise these questions and propose solutions and to participate in debates in a way that's not so easy in places like Canada or Australia. While we do have a handful of Indigenous members in the federal parliament, for example, they're not elected predominantly by Indigenous people, and therefore they're not directly accountable to Indigenous people. So they're not, they're participants in parliament, certainly, and that's important, but they're not representatives of Indigenous nations or Indigenous citizens. And that means that the idea of democratic accountability to Indigenous Australians is simply not present. It's not possible in the way that democracy works at present, because we're talking about such a very small proportion of the voting public. And it's to correct that we get arguments in favour of an Indigenous voice to Parliament, for example. The opposition has agreed to a referendum on the idea of a voice to Parliament being entrenched in the Commonwealth Constitution. The government's very much opposed, arguing that it would constitute a third chamber of Parliament and somehow have an equivalent status to the Senate and the House of Representatives. That's a misrepresentation of the argument, which is simply that Indigenous peoples didn't agree to the establishment of colonial government. Indeed, they were explicitly excluded from the negotiations that took place prior to Federation and which formed the basis of the Commonwealth Constitution. So this is really about acknowledging that, recognising that history, and admitting that in order to mitigate some of the effects of political exclusion, a substantive measure of inclusion is justified. And what it would mean to have a voice to Parliament is that there would be a national voice that has the authority of the Indigenous populations around the country. It would be elected by them in ways that they determine as appropriate. So it would be an authoritative voice in that sense. And it would have the capacity to critique whatever legislation was before Parliament and look at it from a uniquely Indigenous perspective. So it wouldn't have to be negotiating in the way that the Senate crossbench negotiates with government to get its views incorporated into legislation and so on. It would be arguing from an independent perspective and asking the Australian people, as well as the Australian Parliament, to think about those perspectives and to include them in their deliberations on public policy. So it would be a form of active participation. At the moment, it's very fashionable in Australia for governments to consult or even co-design policy measures with Indigenous nations. And there's a lot of dissatisfaction with how that works in practice, because consultation is very much a relationship of junior and senior partnerships. So is co-design often, whereas participation is a much higher level of engagement. And if it's a constitutionally enshrined level of engagement, that gives it an authority. That's an expression of the whole Australian community saying, we understand the impact of colonisation, and we understand that ensuring that your voice is always present, as you want it to be, in a form that you want it to be, is a way of mitigating that. And that's why I think the the voice to Parliament is important, and it can make democracy work better.
Mm. A voice to Parliament, just one way Australia and New Zealand seem to have differed. As discussed, a central theme within your book is citizenship. You argue the UN Declaration has the potential to remake public institutions in ways that create the political capacity to realise rights grounded in prior occupancy. Now, the lands of Australia and New Zealand both were occupied prior to colonialisation. The British Crown, however, signed an agreement in 1840 with about 540 Maori chiefs, forming the Treaty of Waitangi. Australia has no such treaty. Another way the two countries differ. What has the treaty done for the capacities of citizenship as Māori, and how might the UN Declaration, you know, enhance the dignity for both Indigenous in Australia and New Zealand?
Well, the Treaty of Waitangi is a very short agreement. It has three articles. The first gave Britain the right to establish government. The second affirmed the Māori right to what is called in the Māori language rangatiratanga. Well, that's the loosely translated as chiefly authority, and understood today as authority to make decisions in relation to their own affairs and their own resources. So by resources, we could mean land and you know, the minerals and so on beneath the land, water, and cultural resources like language too, most importantly. And thirdly, the Treaty of Waitangi gave Māori what in 1840 was referred to as the rights and privileges of British subjects. Subjecthood in 1840 wasn't really a particularly substantive political right, but over time it's evolved into New Zealand citizenship. And citizenship is a right that's constantly evolving and taking on different forms and including new political capacities and so on. And the treaty means that as those capacities of citizenship evolve, Māori are entitled to participate and share in those just as much as anybody else. And citizenship really is a voice in how society works. So it challenges the idea that you have a colonial society made up of non-Indigenous peoples that is dominant and runs everything. And if it feels like it, it consults Indigenous people to see what they think and see if it wishes to admit those thoughts into its ways of operating and its deliberations and so on. Citizenship, however, comes back to that point we were talking about earlier. If it's citizenship that gives government the consent to exist, basically, that Parliament derives its authority by the consent of the people, of the citizens, then it seems reasonable by virtue of the Treaty of Waitangi that Māori are part of that equation as much as anybody else. So that also comes back to what we were talking about earlier about the right to go to school and learn in one's language, the right to go to school and know that one's culture is accepted as part of the way in which the school operates. It doesn't have to be left behind. There's some important educational research in New Zealand based on the idea that Māori kids should be able to go to school and achieve as Māori. In other words, they don't have to assimilate into the dominant culture to have any chance of educational success. And there's a lot of work being done on what that means exactly and how that works for Māori citizens. But in Australia, where, you know, the idea of bilingual schooling or the idea that culture has some kind of affirmed place in the classroom is still quite contested and quite radical, then that kind of right of citizenship, which is actually affirmed in the UN Declaration, is not really being upheld, and it's one of the things that the Declaration would actually change quite radically for Australia if it were implemented. The Declaration speaks specifically of Indigenous peoples having the right to educate people in their own cultures and languages, and the right to participate in decisions about what schools are for, how they operate, and why they operate. So it's really about affirming the voice of the citizen in public decision making. And, you know, you can make the same argument in respect of how health systems work. And in Australia, there are perhaps better models there with the Aboriginal community-controlled medical organisations, where communities really do have a genuine say in how primary health care is delivered and the kinds of priorities that are needed in particular communities and so on. There have been proposals that system needs to be strengthened and so on, and some quite interesting arguments have been raised about whether there ought to be an Indigenous health purchasing authority so that the Indigenous authority, rather than government departments of health and so on, contract with these Aboriginal medical organisations, health organisations, to work out what kinds of services need to be provided and so on. And a similar argument is actually being raised in New Zealand in response to the finding of a public inquiry that there is still significant systemic racism in the health system. And one of the recommendations of that inquiry was an independent authority needs to be established, and it needs to comprise Māori health professionals and so on, who would make decisions about how the Māori health budget is spent and target it appropriately as they saw fit, and in turn be accountable to Māori citizens for the success and efficacy of their decisions. So putting institutions into the state to allow it to consider Indigenous voices across all policy domains is one of the outcomes we'd see if the declaration were to have significant influence.
Mm. Race relations have become a topic of great significance of late. Yeah, First Nations race relations have a long and turbulent history in Australia. How do you rationalise what it means in political practice for both Indigenous and settler populations to recognise the other's presence?
Well, that's one of the tasks for treaties to work out. And I think what's really important there in this perspective is that that not be prescribed from outside the Indigenous nations concerned. That they have the right and the obligation to work that out for themselves and to negotiate it with, whether it's the state or territory government or the Commonwealth government, to negotiate those in ways that work for them and uphold the political authority that they maintain they never ceded. And that might differ from one Indigenous nation to another. But I know that some people are looking at the Treaty of Waitangi, for example, in New Zealand, as an example that might influence their thinking, not as a prototype that they might simply copy, but as a way of thinking about, well, what does it mean for us to have our own independent authority, and what does it mean for us to have a voice in public affairs, and what does it mean for the state to accept and guarantee that, and to what extent and in what form does the state have to do that for it to be acceptable for us? And those are really difficult local political questions that have to be worked out.
And what weight do principles and intentions and spirit sort of carry in a relationship that something like a Treaty of Waitangi could possibly provide?
Well, ultimately it comes down to political will, and that's the obstacle in Australia. I recall an Australian Medical Association report a couple of years ago which looked at the incidence of Indigenous rheumatic heart disease and looked at some solutions to that. And its conclusion was ultimately that the solutions are not clinical. They're not actually about what health practitioners do in their clinics when they have to work with Indigenous patients. They're about political will. And the argument was there's no reason for that kind of disease to be a a real problem in Indigenous communities in ways that it's not in other parts of Australia, but that the reason it is a real problem is, the absence of political voice in the setting of health policy, the setting of wider social policies that, contribute to that and other diseases. So people might see treaties as an opportunity to say, well, actually, we know what the problems are in terms of poor health among our people. It's not just money, but it's how we spend it, and it's who decides how it's spent and how and why and so on. And we need political institutions, political relationships that allow us to be part of those decisions. And people might well want to think, well, being part of those decisions is a little bit more than being consulted with. It's perhaps a little bit more than policy co-design, but it's actually policy leadership. So what kind of institutional arrangements do we need? What kind of political values do we need to allow for that leadership to occur? And different peoples will have different answers to those questions, and they'll have different solutions as well. But what we first and foremost, I think, are lacking in Australia outside of Victoria and the Northern Territory is a genuine government commitment to enter into those discussions. And a voice to Parliament would, while it's separate from treaties, would provide a forum in which those arguments could be advanced and in which people could set out why they think treaties are a good idea and what kind of practical difference they might make.
Dominic, in wrapping up, the title of the book is a strong statement. We are all here to stay. What does this title mean, and what do you hope for the future in this space?
The title comes from a judgment in the Canadian Supreme Court where Chief Justice Lamer made that observation. And I take that to mean that Indigenous peoples are here to stay as Indigenous. And that's really significant. Lamer also meant that post-settler populations are here to stay and that's that. But that doesn't mean that colonialism is here to stay in its current form. And it doesn't mean that just because the post-settler populations are here to stay, Indigenous peoples need to assimilate into dominant cultures. And that idea that we are all here to stay as Indigenous is really important, because that imagines a different kind of political relationship and a different kind of political status where Indigenous people are no longer subjects of a colonial society, but participants in the forging of a post-colonial society and participants in determining what it actually would take for a post-colonial reality to emerge. So what do we actually mean if we set post-colonialism as an objective? We can't undo colonialism. We can't pretend it never existed. But we can, to some extent, overcome its negative impacts.
And that wraps up today's conversation. Dominic, this is a deeply fascinating subject that I could ask you about all day. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
That was Associate Professor in Political Science, Dominic O'Sullivan, on the release of his new book, We Are All Here to Stay. You can find the book on the ANU Press website. It's electronically available at no cost, and print copies are available for purchase. My name's Ruben Spargo. Thank you for joining us. Take care. Bye now.